Thanks for listening to the Adam Carolla Show on Podcast One.
All right. Well, first half, we did a little audible, and we're just going to go with Kirstie Alley for the whole show because she's just so scintillating, so interesting, and I just found myself falling in love with the woman. So lots of good stories from her. First, I'll tell you about LifeLock. Nearly 50,000 falsified unemployment claims in Maryland. More than $500 million in claims. Maryland isn't alone. Other states are finding similar unemployment fraud themselves. It's important to understand how cybercrime and identity theft are affecting our lives. Look, it's the new, I don't know, when I was younger, they would steal your car stereo. That's what criminals did. Now, they're not going to get cut on any glass or bit by a dog. They're just going to steal your identity. LifeLock detects a wide range of identity threats like your social security number for sale on the dark web. If they detect your information, they'll send you an alert. Protect yourself with LifeLock, right, Dawson?
No, that's all identity theft or monitor all transactions at all businesses. LifeLock and see threats you might miss on your own. Join now and save up to 25% off your first year by using promo code Adam. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK or head to LifeLock.com. Use promo code Adam for 25% off. Back inside the toolbox where we only stop this ride to pick up hitchhikers. Working on another superset of the 70s, and this band had me thinking, how many bands name themselves after fruit? The greatest, of course, being Moby Grape. But add to that fruity list this boring band branding with a sweet sobriquet, Raspberries. Who, though the name is lame, they follow the Nashville idiom, don't bore us, get to the chorus. There's plenty of room in the back of this van on the toolbox. Never knew how complete love could be. She kissed me and said, baby, please go away. If it's so unlikely. From Carolla One Studios in Glendale, California, this is the Adam Carolla Show. Adam's guest today, Kirstie Alley. Plus, Dave Damashek is here for Good Sports, and now, not in the majority, and definitely not silent, Adam Carolla.
Yeah, get it on. Got to get on a trip. Thanks for tuning in. Thanks for telling a friend. I love that about you. By the way, I love that Raspberry song, man. It's one of the best just pop songs ever. All right, a little different change of pace today. I am speaking to Kirstie Alley, and I think we're just going to go all the way through with her because she's so goddamn fascinating. Kirstie, good to see you. Good to meet you. I'm not even sure if I've met you before.
I don't think we've met.
That is weird because I've been hanging around this town for 25 years. You got here before I did. I think at some point our paths would cross.
You would think, but I'm sort of a reckless. So unless you were in my living room, it might not have happened.
Well, I've always been a fan of yours. And I guess I caught on to you. I probably first saw you on Cheers back when. And I was reading about you today in preparation for this. And there's something that it might not mean a lot to people who are listening, but for someone who's done it, meaning Dancing with the Stars, you did a dance where you got a perfect score. You got 3 tens from the judges. I am telling everyone that is nearly impossible. Is someone, you know, my highest score was like, you know, 17 and a half or something. Like getting a 30 on a dance is almost impossible. And that means A, you can dance, but B, you're super focused. Like you just worked, you have to work it and repeat it over and over again.
No, I think it was a mercy fuck, really. I think I'm older and they felt sorry for me. So they said, give her 3 tens. She's good for the ratings.
Yeah. The mercy fuck is like an 8 and 2 9s, but 3 tens. They don't just hand that shit out.
I didn't work that hard. I tried to work, but my partner yelled at me all the time because I wasn't working hard enough. I mean, when I started it, I wasn't taking it that seriously, you know, but towards the end, maybe everybody, it's like war or something. It's scary.
I was talking to Mike August, who I know booked you, and he called me the other day, and he said, I was just on the phone with Kirstie Alley for an hour and 15 minutes, and it sounded like I was talking to you. He said, you guys have to talk. Every single thing she said sounds like it's coming out of your mouth. So I don't know why it took this long for us to get together.
I know. I was just listening to, I was listening to your podcast with Rob Schneider, and I thought, what are we going to talk about? Because you guys talked about everything. It's like there were three. It was like the triplets. And I'm like, what am I going to now talk about? What do I have to say?
Well, you we'll delve into everything. You're in where are you in Wichita right now?
I'm in Wichita, Kansas. This is my hometown. And I've come here to see my dad. My dad's 96. He's in a nursing home. And they, you know, they got him on lockdown. So my dad luckily is on the first floor. So I go to his window and he's 96. So I don't know. I have him on FaceTime and I'm at his window and he's deaf. So it's a bit of a, you know, I say, no, look at the FaceTime. Look at the FaceTime when I'm asking you a question so he can read my lips.
Your dad. So you grew up in a like almost a different era. I mean, it was, but I mean, almost, it didn't seem like, it seemed like 200 years ago. Your dad ran a lumber mill or sawmill or something like that. Your mom was a housewife.
He owned a wholesale lumber company.
A lumber company.
Yeah.
And you grew up in a very kind of traditional way, right?
I'd say yes.
And you went off to college, but you soon dropped out to make your way to LA. Is that correct?
No, that's not really correct. I went to college because I was afraid my boyfriend from high school was going to cheat on me because he was going to college. So I just went to college and I took riflery and flower arranging and creative writing. And then when he graduated, I married him.
Mm-hmm.
And then I married him and then I left him. Then I went to California.
Oh, okay. Sorry for screwing that up. Were you involved or did you work in interior design for a while?
Yeah, I was an interior designer professionally for about 6 years until that's one of the things. I had all these jobs. When I moved to Los Angeles, I didn't really move there to be an actress, but then I decided I wanted to be one. So I was being an interior designer there. I'd been one in Kansas for 4 years professionally. And then when I went to LA, I was being an interior designer, working in a hat store. You remember those cowboy hats called Caspel Tweed? And they were sort of groovy looking cowboy hats that everybody wore for a while. Yeah. Well, I worked for Malin Lucas at Caspel Tweed. And then I was a housekeeper for men only because they really appreciate it if you make their magazines look nice, put a nice roll of toilet paper, put their towels. I just got so many accolades for my good work as a housekeeper. And I decided to not do any housekeeping for any women. Because they're snobby about it. And men are like, oh, my God, look at the way you put my magazines. Oh, my God, where'd you get these flowers?
Well, don't you kind of think they were all attracted to you?
No, I don't think they were attracted to me. They didn't act like they were attracted to me. I just think they liked the way I folded their towels or something. I don't know.
Well, you know, I always think about people, well, like people like yourself who are very physically attractive. Like you're very good looking person. And well, listen, I got a TV, I got eyeballs. And I'm just saying it seemed like a lot of people would probably come up to you and say, you should model, you should act, you should do something like that. Was that the case when you were younger?
Well, no, when I was in Kansas, people said things to me like, you should stop snorting coke. You should stop doing whatever you're doing. You should, you know, go back to school. You're actually an idiot. I don't, you know, Kansas sort of puts you straight somehow. I don't know. The Midwest sort of puts you straight. I wasn't really impressing people then. And when I moved to Hollywood, I don't think I was impressing anybody there. I think I got acting jobs like I got to be a cheerleader. I could jump really high. I wasn't popular, but I could jump really high. So I got to be a cheerleader at my school. And then in Hollywood, I my first job was, you know, basically looking like a Vulcan. So I got that job. But those are freaky, you know.
That was Star Trek, the movie, I think, right?
Star Trek 2, Wrath of Khan.
Right. And, of course, Veronica's Closet and Cheers, Summer School, Forgot about that movie. Look Who's Talking, all three of them, I guess, with Travolta, right?
Yes.
Was that a Scientology thing? Did you know Travolta through Scientology?
No, I had never met him before. In fact, I met him for the very first time when I was really full of myself. I don't know what movie I'd just done. I just finished something and I thought I was like the best fucking actress to ever hit the planet. And so I was called about doing this movie with Travolta and I was so cocky. I was like, well, you know, let me meet him. So my agent had John and come over and his agent come over to his house and I met him. And that was the first time I'd met him. And I don't think he knew who the hell I was, really. I never asked him that question, but I don't think he really knew who I was.
Are you still involved with Scientology?
Yeah.
How does that play a role in your life?
Well, you know, it sort of changes, you know. When I first started doing Scientology, like I said, I was a pretty good cokehead, and I really didn't like the way that I didn't like that I had a compulsion, put it that way. So one time I met this girl in Wichita, Kansas, that I didn't even like because I'm not even going to go into that story. But she said she was a Scientologist. And I said, can they help you get rid of a compulsion? I didn't really care that I did cocaine. I cared that I had the compulsion to do it.
No, let's talk about that for a second, because I know what you're saying. It's not like the cocaine per se, you know, especially when you're young. It's not really hurting you. It's not really doing anything or whatever. But the fact that you would like to quit, but you can't quit, that part bothered you.
The thing that bothered me, like, you know, I'd snort so much coke that then my heart would start palpating. And then I'd be sitting there ready to go out on a date and I'm snorting coke. And then I'm feeling my pulse. And then I'd go like, I'm dying. I'm dying. Oh my God, I'm going to die. I'm going to die. I'm going to die. And then I'd become religious. And I go, oh my God, don't let me die. If you don't let me die, then I won't do any more coke. I swear to God. I swear to God. Boom, then it would smooth out. And then I'd go out and I'd be like fine for 3 or 4 hours. And I'd snort too much coke and I'd be like, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. So I didn't understand why a person like me, who I made it through high school and college without ever doing a drug. And I didn't understand how a person like me could become this person that is afraid I'm going to die and actually really afraid that I'm going to die and actually really afraid that I'm losing myself. I felt like I guess the best way to describe it was it feels like you're invisible as a being, you know, you're there as a body, but you're invisible. And I hated the way I felt. So why did I just do it the next weekend that came up? It was mystifying to me. So that's what I
was. How old are you at this point?
When I left, I was about 27 or 28.
And
I was way after I should have done drugs. I met a guy, I fell in love, he had some coke. And how about this? The first time I snorted coke, I was like this, and I'd never done any drugs. I was like, and I went, oh my God, I'm going to do this every day for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
Because when I say I hadn't done any other drugs, I smoked pot twice, but I don't like that, didn't like that downtrodden.
Yeah. No, listen, so, I've told people, I had a friend, I was too poor to do cocaine. Like when cocaine was, I mean it, when cocaine was popular, if you do the math on like cocaine and its popularity, kind of mid 80s, I lived in Los Angeles. I was making $8 an hour on a construction site. Coke was $110 a gram.
Exactly.
It's a lot cheaper now, and now I'm rich and coke is free. So now would be a good time for me to dip my foot into the coke pool. But then I was making $8 an hour with taxes being taken out. A gram of cocaine was a day and a half's work for me after taxes. And I remember people around me like doing it and stuff, but it's like, When you're getting $8 an hour for digging ditches, how could you get a coke? Now, if I was a hot chick and I had a boyfriend, then maybe I could pull it off. But I was a dumb dude and I didn't have that. So that was the only way I would have been able to pull off. But I had a friend. He worked on Miami Vice, the TV show. He came back to L.A. in the 80s. He had really good coke, and I tried it with him, and I was like, oh, my God, this is what everyone's talking about. This is awesome. Like, I get it. I get why people get strung out on this shit. When you try the really good stuff, you go, oh, I've never felt better in my life. And I get why people like this.
I get why they like it, and I get why I liked it. But it is like the – it really is demonic because, you know, that it really is that high of something that's this big, and then the next time it's this big, and then the next time it lasts this long, and then it lasts this long, and finally you're sitting there snorting coke all night long. You're not really high anymore. It just won't work anymore. And then you start getting paranoid. You know, I'd be standing at the drapes looking for the cops, looking for, I don't know, what the hell? And I just became a lunatic. I hated myself. I was horrible.
How much would you do? I mean, like, what would you do on a weekend?
I really wasn't like a guy who did it every single day, but I would do it 3 days a week. And I would probably snort 2 or 3 grams a night. That's $200 or $300. And, you know, I was working as an interior designer and I was making good money, but I lived with someone who was Richie Rich.
Right.
So Richie Rich and I, and he had already had his drug days. So, but I was the one that goes, well, let me try this. So,
How long did this go on?
I did coke for about 4 years.
Wow. That's a long time for what you're describing.
Yeah, but I really did go insane. When people say like, even then, I remember I was nuts. I said to my mom and dad, they're the straightest people in the world. And I said, oh, just so you know, do you guys want to, God, would you guys like to try some coke? And my dad and mom were like, what? And I go, cocaine. You know, like, do you want, would you like to do it? And they go, we don't even know what you're talking about. I go, cocaine, it's a drug. Well, are drugs good? I go, well, this one is. This one would make you feel really good. This is something you might like. I can't even believe the things that I did or said. I'm just nuts.
So what in this period, what are you doing? Are you working as an interior designer?
Yes.
You have a rich boyfriend who's
right.
Older and past his drug prime.
No, he's only a couple of years older. But look, like I said, I didn't do drugs in high school or college.
Right.
So when I didn't start doing drugs until I was 24, I'm a late bloomer in everything.
So now you feel like this thing has a grip on you.
It did.
And you don't like the idea of walking around with something that has sort of dominion over you, right?
I didn't. And also, when I say this, I really want people to understand, not people, you, was insane. I knew I had made myself insane by doing this drug. I didn't start out a lunatic midway through. And at the end, I was a lunatic. I couldn't, sometimes I would feel uncomfortable in my own skin. I couldn't be anywhere. Sometimes I made myself nuts. Seriously. I made myself insane. And so and because I knew the difference and because I knew that I was the one that did it, I thought if I'm the one that did it, I can undo it.
Mm-hmm. So where does Scientology then enter your life?
Well, that was the girl. Okay. So when I lived with this guy, Jake, who was a very cool guy, but he was Richie Rich, right? Anyway, so his friend who I'd also sort of been to high school with, but I didn't really like her, came into town to visit him. And, I was sort of being a smart ass and I was like, so I hear you're a Scientologist. And she goes, yeah, I am. And you know, she's being real upbeat and I'm being a douche. And I said, so let me just ask you one question. Is that something that could help me get rid of the compulsion to do cocaine? And she said, yeah, it really is. And I said, well, why don't you send me a book? So she sent me a book. I liked what it said. It described me. It described my kind of crazy that I didn't want. It wasn't good crazy. So it described it. So I actually picked up, packed up, but listen to this. Oh my God. And I was on my way to LA to do Scientology. There wasn't Scientology in Kansas. And, you know, to drive to LA takes 2 days, but it took me 26 days because I had to score cocaine everywhere across the whole fucking country. And if I had to backtrack 500 or 600 miles, it didn't matter.
So you just drove like the cocaine route from Wichita to Los Angeles.
Yeah, but the cocaine route looked a little bit like oh, I'm in Denver getting coke. Oh, yeah, but someone in Hayes, Kansas has coke. And then, oh, boom, boom, I'm almost in Tahoe. And the weirdest thing happened when I was in Tahoe. Oh, my God. So it was snowing, literally. I was literally snow blind from snorting so much coke, and it was, you couldn't see. Everything was just a whiteout. So I pull into, I don't know, some fancy hotel. It's not in Reno. Was it Reno or Tahoe? Who knows?
Tahoe, probably.
And I pull in, and a person opens the door, and they go, Kirstie Alley. Now, I wasn't an actress. No one knew who the hell I was. And I thought maybe the FBI was waiting for me or something, you know. And this guy, I go, what? And he goes, Kirstie Alley, I went to junior high school with you.
Wow.
I got to get to L.A. I got to get to L.A. because this is the kind of shit that's going to get me in a lot of trouble. But then I went to San Francisco and stayed for 2 weeks snorting coke. And then I went to L.A. and snorted coke.
Did you sort of know that, you know, I've worked with Dr. Drew for many years, you know, and I think when people know they're going into rehab or they know they're going into a place to quit doing what they're doing, people do a lot of eating before the diet starts Monday morning, right? So was that kind of what you were doing? Like, I'm going to do as much coke as I can do before I get to LA and quit?
It was a little bit like that. You know, I had taken on this new boyfriend, the rich boyfriend I broke up with before I left. And I'd taken on this new boyfriend who liked to do heroin. And I didn't even know anything. I'd never seen heroin. I didn't know anything about heroin. I never did heroin. But, you know, I remember being at Manhattan Beach, and you know, I had snorted coke, and then he was chasing the dragon, and I'm like, what is this? I really didn't know what he was doing. And then I'm like, oh, I'm in love with you, I'm in love with you, I'm in love with you. And then I said, look, I'm gonna go do some Scientology. you go to Hawaii and get some heroin, and then as soon as I'm done with my Scientology, then we'll meet up.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did that, and then it came to my, when I thawed out or whatever you want to call it. We met up and I was like, oh my God, what, you know, when, have you ever had that moment when you're out with someone, or maybe it happens to people when they're drunk and then they wake up and they're like, oh my God, it was that moment.
You couldn't believe you're with him. I'm laughing to myself because I'm thinking about someone leaving Wichita, Kansas to come to LA to stop doing coke in the 80s. Like, the whole story is the little girl grows up in Wichita, Kansas, comes to L.A. and starts doing coke. Not comes to L.A. to stop doing coke. That's from true. Wichita. But so what year is this approximately?
This is 1979.
Oh, we haven't even got to the 80s yet.
No, we haven't gotten to the 80s because in the 80s, I didn't do any drugs. You know, it was sort of a, you know, people will have asked me about Scientology before, my own personal story. But honestly, when I did Scientology for 2 weeks, and I never wanted to do a drug again.
Really?
I know that's not like everybody in the universe does that, but literally you could have put a mountain of cocaine in front of me and I would have fire hosed it down. I had zero interest. I went back to being exactly like I was before I ever tried a drug. I always thought drugs were stupid. Why would you do them? I don't want to screw myself up and stuff. So that was a pretty major thing in my life. And I didn't go to LA to be an actor, but after I thawed out, I thought, you know, I sort of rehabilitated my goals that had long been buried. And so then I thought, oh, you know, I'd like to try being an actress. I mean, why not? I can't do anything else except decorate.
What was the protocol? Like, did you just walk into the Celebrity Center over there on Franklin,
oh,
I guess?
Or?
Yeah.
No, I didn't go into Celebrity Center. There's things in Scientology called field. It's a field group. So it's like a private delivery of Scientology services.
And what?
I went there because that's where Anne, the girl that came to Wichita that knew my boyfriend, told me to go. So I went there.
What is the protocol today? Like, is it something you participate in daily?
No, I don't participate in it daily. But now it's sort of based, you know, an example would be like, if you want to do a course, let's say there's something that you feel needs to change in you. and you want to change that thing. And then, so let's say you're a bad communicator. There's a course on communication. So you go in and do a course on communication. It's, Scientology always felt like to me, like college meets religion. So you, and the religion of it is just really getting you to go back to being some kind of analytical thinker instead of a reactive machine or whatever you become when you, not just with drugs, but with other drugs is a good example though, because that's an obvious one, you know?
Go ahead, finish your thought.
So let's say someone's had a loss, they've lost someone they loved, and they've tried and tried and tried and tried to get over that, and they're just stuck there. That's something Scientology could help.
Did you go to events and things where you see a Tom Cruise or John Travolta or any of those types there?
Of course. If they happen to be there, it's not like, I know people go like, oh, you know, so-and-so, don't you? And I go, no, who is that? Well, they're a Scientologist. I go, there's millions of Scientologists. I know John and Tom, like, you know, John and Tom. They're, you know, I worked with John before I was a Scientologist. I actually met Tom through Mimi Rogers, his first wife,
right,
who was my roommate.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
In LA, obviously.
In LA.
Where'd you guys live in LA?
We lived in Studio City.
Oh, really? Well, I'm from North Hollywood. So where in Studio City did you guys live?
We lived on the corner, almost like Sepulveda and, was it Hazeltine or something? There's these apartments. There's sort of
1930s. It's kind of your borderline Van Nuys, Sherman Oaks.
But you don't say that.
Yeah, you don't say that. You say Studio City. That's right. My mom's house, her neighborhood got so shitty that they changed it from North Hollywood to Valley Village because North Hollywood had a little stink of failure on the name. So you get into acting and you're good at it. I mean, you're a really strong comedic actress. I mean, Emmys and Golden Globes, like for someone who didn't really do it in high school or college, you had a real knack for it.
Well, I like I said, I'm not even kidding when I say I really don't know how to do anything else. I know how to do interior design and I think that I learned how to act. Let's say that.
Did you study? Did you treat it like a craft? Did you?
No.
It's just in you.
Look, no, I'll tell you when I feel really humiliated. Because, you know, I'll watch the Actors Studio and I hear actors talking and they've worked at their craft and they call it their craft. And I have nothing in common with them. And it makes me feel like if I was ever going to be on the Actors Studio, which I think I was invited to be, but I don't know what I was doing other than that, I feel like I would be a total disappointment because I like acting just because I like it. I think it's super fun and I think it's interesting and it makes me, it makes my life happy, you know, especially when I do comedy. You probably know that. I live a very happy life. All the years of Cheers, anytime I'm doing comedy, I'm not one of those people that, you know, you've met a lot of comedians. I'm sure that they're very serious and they're depressed and they're dark and they're this.
It's true that comedians want to talk about the process a lot. And I'm like, it'd just be funny think of something funny and write it down and then say it on stage. They overcomplicate it with the process. It's a little, I don't know. It's a little blowhardy. I'm with you.
It's
a little pretentious.
I don't want to be around actors talking about their fucking craft and how they came about it and how they have the right to do that and they could come to about it in their own mind. When I'm around people, I don't ever want to hear them talk about how great they are, how wonderful they are in their craft, who loves them, who they got, you know, I got a letter the other day from so-and-so saying they just love my show and I don't like that.
How about entering Cheers? Now, like Cheers had been on for a number of seasons, was a huge hit. I mean, if it wasn't the number one sitcom on TV, it was top three every week in and week out. You're going to take over. Was it Shelley Long? Who was that?
Yeah.
Shelley Long is the show is such a big hit that Shelley Long is going to go off and start doing features, I guess. And replacing her on that sitcom at that time is like playing, it's like starting for the short, for the Yankees at shortstop, right? I mean, how many actresses would love to have that role that's already been created? I mean, not your role wasn't created, but I mean, a sitcom that's already a bona fide winner in the ratings and a juggernaut. How old were you when you walked onto that set?
Oh my God. When did I walk on this set? 1987. I walked onto this set. How old am I? I didn't start acting until I was 30 or 31 or something like that. 30, 31. So I think I was born in 51, 87. Does that make me 36?
Yeah.
I think it was 36 when I did that.
And then how were you pinching yourself or did you just kind of take it in?
No, I look, sometimes my life is ignorance is bliss because I was off doing a movie with Tom Berenger and Sidney Poitier. So I'm like, I am so hot. I'm in this movie with Sidney Poitier, you know, who's like my, and Tom Berenger just coming off of Platoon. And I'm like, oh my God, I'm everything. So when they called to ask me, the casting director, Jeff and Jimmy Burrows, I guess had seen me do Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, which isn't a comedy. So when they say, oh, we saw you do that, so we want you in our comedy, it's sort of, you know, like, what was I doing in Cat on a Hot Tin Roof? Anyway, so they called me and wanted me to come in and meet Ted and go to lunch and do that. And I'd never seen Cheers. And I tuned in and I thought he looked like Eddie Munster. And also, I didn't know much about sitcoms, so I was like, yeah, okay. Well, but I had only done drama in movies, so I thought, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to do this for a year and show people that maybe I could be funny, and then I'll go do funny movies. So that was my plan. I wasn't really scared because I didn't really know the magnitude of what I was getting into. You know, if you think like, wow, I'm over here with Sidney Poitier and you want me to go to TV. Well, come on, you know?
Yeah, no, I get it. I've kind of been there a little bit myself where you're just sort of showing up and doing the work and going home and not really sucking it all in or drinking it all in. Or maybe it's a way to prevent yourself from being overwhelmed. Maybe it's a like self-preservation
thing. Take it that, you know, I had good jobs over here doing movies. So if I didn't get this, it wouldn't be that I wouldn't be disappointed, but I still had the good job over here doing movies, you know? So I don't know. I did a mini series and I got to spend all day with Jimmy Stewart and he sort of wrapped it up for how I feel too. Every time he said, every time I walk off a set, I think I'm a loser. And every time I get hired, I think I'm a scam artist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He's always like, what do they see? I don't even get it. I don't even get why they want me to be in this movie. And I'm a little bit like that. So we really hit it off because I understood. And he had monkeys. He had a lot of monkeys and they'd come in his bedroom with he and his wife at night. So
Jimmy Stewart owned monkeys?
Yeah.
Did not
and
know
I
that.
Have lemurs. So I was talking about my lemurs. He was talking about his monkeys. We really hit it off. We're both obviously some kind of freaks about, you know, every time I do, I agree with him. Every time I walk off a set, I go, I'm never going to work again.
What's your relationship with Hollywood these days?
I mean, I go in and out. I'll go in and out and work, you know. I think the last time I went in and worked on a series or something was Scream Queens. And then the last movie I did was in October, but that was in Atlanta. So, I love Hollywood. I love acting. I love the whole deal. I just don't take it as seriously as I think I should. And I think that's probably gotten me into situations where maybe I'm not taking or doing the best work in the world. You know, you mentioned Tom Cruise. Tom is a friend of mine. Tom, when he's going to do a movie, months and months he will work on it. You know, like that one movie, the one last Mission Impossible, where he's being swirled around in all that water and that crazy stuff, you know, he was practicing to hold his breath, I think up to 6 minutes. Now he, so every day, day and night, he's in that pool working with the world's free divers, best free divers, to learn to hold his breath 6 minutes so we can do that scene with no cut.
Right.
Now that describes Tom. I am like, I don't give a fuck. It's a movie. Do cuts. Who gives a shit? Put a body double in there. Let them get all churned up, you know? So I'm not saying, I don't feel like I'm as credible in that craft as I probably should be. How about you?
You know, I toggle kind of back and forth. Like, there's a part of me that thinks, don't you want to put your best foot forward, like, sort of all the time? You know, like, you can go do a stand-up show somewhere, and you can really prepare to do that stand-up show, or you can shoot a stand-up special, and you can really work it. And then there's another part that kind of goes, well, if you're taking this creative thing and you're kind of turning it into boot camp and in a business, and you're back in the ninth grade and you want to get an A on your oral report, then are you kind of defeating the purpose? And, you know, I think of sports. I think about the guys who had the Hall of Fame careers because they worked so hard during the off season. And then I thought about the guys that wanted to party during the off season and not treat it like it was their entire life. And then sort of who's the joke on? Like, I was watching the movie Rush the other day, the Ron Howard movie about Niki Lauda, the F1 racer, and James Hunt. And James Hunt was the freewheeling blonde playboy guy. And he was like, Nikki, the sum of life isn't to keep working for next year. It's to have fun. You know, like, I just won the championship. I want to party. I want to get laid. I want to travel, you know? And I think the answer is they're both right. You know, Niki Lauda and Tom Cruise are both right. And on one side of the aisle, and you and James Hunt are right on the other side of the aisle too. And so I think then I balance. I think it's about balance. I think it's about saying, I don't have to constantly drill and work and rehearse, because all it does, what happens is you do a project, or there's a race season or a football season or whatever it is, and you're either in the season or you're practicing for the next season, and then you blink your eyes and you spent your whole life basically just rehearsing or playing. But right. Or practicing or playing, I would say, you know, you treat it like a diet. It's like you try to have a general nutrition and you try to get some exercise, but have your cheat days.
Well, that's never been successful for me, as we know.
Well, how is that going for you? Because I know famously that was a big deal for you, the weight and the Weight Watchers and all that stuff.
Look, if I would say, like, how would I like to live my life? I would like to be the best I can be and the happiest I can be with the littlest effort.
Right.
So my whole life, I stayed skinny and fit without doing very much, you know, and that's the way I liked it. And then when I turned about, I think I was about 53, the fucking party was over, because I've always eaten a lot of food. If I wanted spaghetti, I wasn't having a cup of spaghetti, do you know?
Right.
5 cups of spaghetti, and I could do it till I was 53. So I got a free ride till I was 53. Then it became like, oh my God, this is, I don't know. You know, then it was foreign to me in a way, and I had to work at it. And it's not like, I'm not trying to portray myself as someone who doesn't work hard.
Mm-hmm. We sound like it.
I sort of would rather not, though, if I don't have to, you know. Like you said, I won some awards, and I did sort of put my nose to the grindstone and work harder. Or if it was with a drama, yeah, I'm in there. I'm learning my lines better. I'm not off researching my character, you know, for 6 months before I do it. And then when I see certain people who do that and they turn in this insanely brilliant performance, then I'm like, I need to go off and research my characters.
Well, So can I circling back to food for a second? Cause I feel you. I'll speak personally.
Okay.
What ends up happening is your metabolism is good enough to take care of not getting fat. So you just kind of eat what you want. You do what you want. That's it. Then at a certain point, you wake up and you realize, oh, if you just keep eating and doing what you were doing, you will start getting fat. So then you say, all right, I got to put a little effort in now. I got to work out a little bit harder. I got to do this. I got to do that. And you start doing it and you realize, oh, I have to do that just to stay even. Now, it's not like I'm going to get in shape or I'm going to cut a bunch of weight. No, I have to work out just to not get fat. It's not like, you know, it's not like you look great at the beach. And then you start thinking about food a lot, because now you're starting to like count calories and calories in and calories out. And now you find yourself thinking about food all day. And anytime you start thinking about something all day, it doesn't really work. The best way, you know, when I was young, I'd just leave the house and I'd just be gone all day and I wouldn't think about food and I'd just eat when I get home. Now, like, I'm at home and I'm always thinking, like, okay, don't eat this, eat that. Thinking that, it's the same with masturbation. Like, you go, don't masturbate. It's like, pow, it's on right now as we speak. No, but you know what I'm saying? You can't sit around and not think about...
That's why our hands are in our laps.
That's right. What I'm saying is if sitting around and think about not smoking, not masturbating, not eating, all it does is lead to not doing cocaine. It's like you end up just doing it more.
Right, because you feel like, I don't know about you and y'all and everyone else, but this is how I feel. Like I quit smoking now for 3 years, but I've also quit smoking for 8 years before or 7 years before or whatever. So I'll hit these points where... Let's say I'm with my friends from Italy and they're all smoking and they never fucking die from cigarettes, apparently, and they never gain weight and they never anything.
Right.
So I'm like, well, I want to smoke too. And I want to eat what you're eating and I want to do what you're doing. It's this bratty kind of, it's being a brat. It's like, I want to have that and I don't want that effect that it causes. And someone will say to me, you know, if you just carry a big bottle of water around with you all the time, and when you feel like you're hungry, you just drink one of those bottles of water. You know, that's every girl in LA, basically.
Right.
And or if you, well, why don't you just have that piece of, why don't you just have that lemon bar right there? Just cut it in half and then you can have it. But there's this like thing that will be like, I don't want to have the lemon bar. I want the same kind of lemon bar that I had when I grew up. I want 5 lemon bars and nobody's skinny and hot.
Yeah. I know.
Isn't this urge to have, and you know, and some people say like, well, that's, you know, that's really not true. When you get older, your metabolism really doesn't change that much. So what did happen to me? So I'm walking along doing the same, eating everything and doing everything and blah, blah, blah. And then I'm 53 and I guess I'm lucky that I made it that far too.
Well, you know, it's kind of,
I don't want to die fat because I don't want people to like have to carry me, you know, like my bedroom in my house in Wichita is on the third floor. And when I go to bed, I go, God, please don't let me die because I really don't want to have stories about me carrying me down from the third floor and being dead and fat.
Yeah. I'm laughing. Sorry, but. Yeah, no, I love that everyone has horrible thoughts before they go to bed. I love that. And, you know, here's an interesting thought. But you tell me what you think.
Okay.
There are people that don't have your metabolism and they don't have your genes. I've met women this way. I've met men this way. I've met women and men that have fantastic genes and metabolisms and everything. And then there are others that are constantly working, constantly having to fight that fight. And that fight starts, you know, when they're in high school. You know what I mean? And sometimes when people are blessed with the metabolism and the genes like you, and I know a few people that are this way, at some point when they get older and it doesn't kick in and now that it's starting to fade a little, they didn't have the discipline that the people in high school that were constantly fighting it every day had, or the self-control. You know what I'm saying? Like, they just, yeah. It's sort of the high school captain of the football team, that jock guy, never really got the discipline and the focus that the other guy who was kind of the overachiever got, who was lucky just to make the team. And then right. when it starts to hit, they're not really armed with that discipline, for lack of a better term.
I do agree. It's like, and you know, like people will say to me, well, have you ever been anorexic? No. I'm like, have you ever been bulimic? No. I mean, I used to wish, like, why can't I try to be bulimic? I stuck my fingers down my throat. I hate throwing up more than anything in the world. That didn't work. I don't think I've ever missed a meal in my life. But it's like you say, it feels like this betrayal. That's why it's a bratty viewpoint, because you had it really good. You maybe didn't realize why you had it so good for so long. You know, like I said, my dad's 96. He looks like a movie star. He's decided he doesn't even want to walk around, but he still could walk around. You know, he's still all there. He has zero dementia.
Wow.
Why do some people, he was fit his whole life. He has a beautiful body. He was like a cross between Robert Mitchum and Rory Calhoun, just naturally, you know? So, and I do know what you mean, because I went to school, high school, with girls who, oh my God, they're counting every calorie and they're drinking water. LA is the, I know I keep bringing up the water, but I mean, my God, in Los Angeles, if you don't live in Los Angeles, you don't realize that every skinny woman has a fucking gallon of water with her 24/7.
It's probably why there's always a drought out here. All the skinny bitches just sucking up all the water, because no, it's true. They'll go, how much do you weigh? I'm like 200 pounds. All right, convert that into ounces. That's 2 million ounces. Now drink half of that in ounces. Take your weight, convert it to ounces, then cut it in half. That's how many ounces you should drink with every meal. It's like 7,000 ounces with every meal. That's right. That's what you should be drinking. I'm like,
and I can't, you know, when I was little, I took dance. Like, I was little, I took acrobat. And then, you know, I messed around being a ballerina, which I was, of course, a dilettante ballerina.
But I knew you could dance.
No, I couldn't dance. I wanted to be a ballerina without having to do any work to, you know, training. But the ballet teacher would say, do not ever drink water. If you can get through the day without drinking, this used to be the philosophy for a ballet.
It's crazy. If you hang around long enough, you'll see it all. So that when I was young and I played Pop Warner football in the San Fernando Valley, like, don't drink water, you'll cramp up. But we'd be running wind sprints, 9-year-olds sweating through our jerseys, and be screaming, don't drink water, don't drink water. Now drink all the water you can.
Which is it? It's the same way with dancers. It's like, don't drink any water, smoke a million cigarettes. Are you eating? What the fuck are you doing eating? Stop eating. So now it's like, you know, now how much water am I supposed to drink? And then I will go, you know what? I'm going to be temperate. I'm just going to be temperate. How much water sounds normal to me? Well, I think I'll have 8 fluid ounces of water, 8 glasses a day, because that's what I've been raised, you know, to believe is right. But that isn't what the skinny girls do, I guarantee you.
Well, I want to talk. I know you lost your mother fairly early. 1981 car accident. I want to get into that. I got many more things to get into with you, but first let me hit Geico here. Right now, Geico is offering an extra 15% off on credit on car, motorcycle, and RV policies. That's 15% on top of the money Geico could already be saving you if you were going with Geico. Never been a better time to switch to Geico and save an extra 15% when you switch by October 7th. So visit geico.com and learn more at geico.com and save that 15%. By the way, Kirstie's going to have a podcast coming soon. And should we direct people to your Twitter to keep an eye out for that?
Yeah, I'm only really on Twitter, but yes, that's a good idea.
Kirstie Alley is where you go on Twitter, and then she'll tell you when her podcast is coming out in September, I think. Yeah, Mike August, that is, said you were had a lot of thoughts about a lot of stuff.
I have too many thoughts about too many. I've become like this, like, raging radical, like some kind of angry beast, I would say.
It's weird. When I was a kid, I felt like everyone mellowed out when they got older, but it doesn't appear to be happening. But I do notice that the men are mellowing out and the women seem to be getting crazier as the years wear on. And
I think with men,
it's the testosterone thing. Like when they're 25, they're all up into everything. They want to fuck and fight every night and everything. And then they get you see these guys at your high school reunion and they're so mellow once, you know, the male pattern baldness kicks in. They put on a couple of pounds and they just kind of mellow right out.
Women they're full of rage because you fucked us for so many years and we fucking hated it that we're like, God. Anyway, I'm not really raging. I'm just, I feel like I've, a lot of things that I felt aren't following suit with what I've known. You know, if you're talking about the political stuff that I was always a Democrat, but what I see now has nothing to do with being a Democrat. And so it's flipped my mind. I don't know what's happening and I am trying to, I'm trying to formulate thoughts and, you know, and really put myself to the test. Am I a racist? Am I a Nazi? Am I this? Did I do this? I know the answer to those questions and they're no, but you have to admit, like, it's sort of freaky now what's going on. So yeah, I have become more outspoken about things that I wasn't ever really outspoken about.
Yeah. Well, it's an interesting time because I've always been a Democrat as well, but the Democratic Party has gone so hard left that I just disagree with most all the stuff they're now talking about. And I've always thought, I've always just kind of cherry picked stuff. Like I like school choice. I think pot should be legal, pro gay marriage. I like a border that we have control of. I'm into lowering the taxes and lowering the regulation and business, you know, going out there and getting a good economy. Like, I don't know. I know you have to find a slot. You have to go, well, that's a Republican thought, and then that's a Democratic thought, and then that's a Republican thought. I don't know why you need to do that. My feeling is you can be pro-gay marriage, Democrat, and pro school choice, Republican. Like, why wouldn't everyone just have both those thoughts?
I don't know, because I feel like thoughts and saying things have now become dangerous. You know what? Here's the thing I really don't like. I don't like that I can't disagree. I don't like that if I am being, you know, it's like being held up at gunpoint. Do you agree with this? If you don't agree with that, you're a fucking Nazi. If you don't agree with that, you're a bigot. If you don't agree with that, that isn't true. So it's like this spin that's being put on everything. And I don't want to agree with everything that everybody thinks is fine. That sounds like a big generalized thing. I don't want to say I like socialism. I don't want to say, yeah, I'm fine. You know, I'll give you an example. I hope this is taken the right way. I feel like if someone's 22 or 23 and they decide that they want to be, they're a man and they want to be a woman and they want to have operations to cut off their genitalia, I feel like, do I agree that that's a good thing? No, but they're 24. They can do what they want. But when I look at kids who say, you know, they're 4 or 5 years old and they're wearing high heels and wearing dresses, I want to be a girl. I want to be a girl. This idea that we must listen to our 5-year-olds who want to be, talk about that, and who then, and then start sort of going in cahoots with grooming them to cut off their genitalia when they're like, some of these guys are like 16, 17. How the hell? I mean, I guess because of the age that I've lived, the amount of years I've lived, all your decisions when you're 4 or 12 are not necessarily your primo decisions to take you through your life. Yeah. So if I say to someone, no, I am not, I am against people having sex change operations until they're well into their adulthood. Well, then you are this or you are that. No, it didn't. I never felt like it used to be that way. And maybe that's what you say when you're old. It didn't used to be that way. But I felt like I could disagree without being called something and canceled. This whole crazy cancel shit. I don't think you take people's livelihoods and people's reputations and just, even if you disagree with them. So this is where it's gotten very complex with me. I'm like you. I say, I believe in same-sex marriage. Good. Same-sex marriage. Good. Blah, 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 blah. Good. Now we have these other things going on that are equally, if not more important right now. You know, we have China doing whatever China is doing right now. I think they're a huge threat. But we're going to talk about these other things that don't cover all the bases, I guess.
Yeah. No, so we're going to talk about
what it falls under for me is human rights. Those are your human rights to do what you want. But you don't. I don't have to go, yes, bravo. Bravo, you're doing this. Why do I have to fucking do that?
I don't know. But if a larger group of us say what you just said, then no one would have to do it. Most of the people are just scared for their jobs, quite honestly. Just a
well,
super,
I don't have a job.
Yeah, well, that's why we get to say what we want. We don't have jobs. But I mean, the woke fucking mob is trying to pull the McCarthyism on everyone. They're hypocrites and they're really bad people. This kind of smear campaign where you're not allowed to give your opinion. And also it's the media, to be fair, you know, because I know people, I know really decent people, and I see what the media tries to do to them. And they're not trying to just fact check them. They're trying to take statements they made and then turn them volitionally, intentionally into a bad human, not a human you disagree with, a bad human. And I realize that it works on a large portion of our society, and it poisons them. And it's not their fault for consuming everything the media gives them, but it's the media's fault as well. I'll give you a perfect example. One of the guys that everyone on the left hates is Dennis Prager because he's Jewish, he's conservative, he's a talk show host, and he's a very religious man with a lot of very conservative thoughts. I happen to get along with Dennis very well, and we're very good friends. We don't have much in common in terms of religion or Judaism or anything like that, but I know him as a very warm and gracious guy, gregarious, very kind to my kids, just a fun guy to hang around with, loves to laugh, and a deep thinker who's a very decent person and very much into America, very loves this country, and is a thoughtful guy. Right. He will say things, and some of the things he'll say would be, for instance, if you're married to a man, and that man is a good man, and he's been with you for a long time, and he's a good husband, and he's a good father, if, in fact, you're not in the mood to have sex with him on any given night, go ahead and do it anyway. Essentially, you got a good guy. He's a man. He's horny. And, you know, if in fact he's a good guy. Now, if he's a bad guy, don't do it. But if he's good, you can occasionally, not if you have a throbbing headache, but if you just like you're not really in the mood, but he's really in the mood, just go ahead. That's what he said. Well, then that comes out with Dennis Prager advocates for marital rape. That's what the headline says. Now, the people that write the article know what he's saying, but they just put it out there that way. And then all the dumb lemmings read the article. They don't read the article. They read the headline. Oh, this guy's he's pro marital rape. And then somebody says to me, fuck that guy, Dennis Prager. And I go, no, Dennis Prager's a really good guy. And they go, oh, yeah, the guy who's for marital rape. You idiots just bought all this stuff, and the news is really, they're getting to the point now where there's a fiduciary duty that they're actually getting dangerous now because of the shit they're saying. They really are. They're going to get people killed.
Chaos merchants,
right?
And the twisty turny. You know, I hear people say, you know, let's say something about Trump, like he's got a big mouth and he says everything and he just won't shut up. And I honestly feel like you have this over here, this extreme over here, and over here you have this extreme, which is so covert, so twisting the truth, like the story you're just telling. You know, that isn't marital rape. That's marital begging.
Right.
So, which is, and that's what I'm saying, the insanity of it. Like, you know, someone said, you know, in the Me Too movement, I get it. We needed a movement. So here we have the women that are raped. Here we have the women that were molested. Here we have a woman who says, you know, this guy pushed me against the wall and kissed me. Well, what the fuck? Don't you want people to kiss you like that? And here's a perfect example. Mike, this is a great analogy that I've said to many people who have a different viewpoint than mine. My cousin lived at my house. She slept in one wing of the house. I had John Travolta as my guest. He was sleeping in another wing of the house. So in this wing of the house was my cousin and a chef we'd hired. So in the morning, she comes in and she's almost in tears. And she goes, oh, my God. I go, what? She goes, Yuri came to my door and he had his underpants on. And he said, and he's from Hungary. And he goes, I would like to have sex with you.
The chef did.
And I said, okay. And then what happened? She goes, I said, no. And then I said, what happened? He left. I said, okay, what's your story? Well, I want you to fire him. I said, well, he came to your door. He was standing in the doorway. He asked you to do this. You said, no, he left. I said, okay, now what if John came down the hall from the other direction to your door? She goes, well, of course I would have said, yes, it's John Travolta. And that was a very keen moment for me, because in the Me Too movement, you had women saying, this man, you know, pushed me against the wall and kissed me, whatever man it was. And then you have this one who raped. It's like, they're not even in the same league.
No, so, I agree. But if you say that, now you're part of the problem, right?
What?
When you say that, which is basically what Matt Damon said, then you get wished out into the cornfield. You are part of the problem for saying things that are patently obvious like that. That's the scary.
You know, I might be, but I'm a woman, and I can say this, that if I have some guy who's coming on to me and he decides to put his arms against the wall and kiss me, I can say, what are you doing? Fucking stop kissing me. Or I can say, yes, this is the best thing that ever happened in my life. Where have you been? Or I can say many things. But the idea that he does that, what are we supposed to really do at this point? I get all horrible things. I'm a woman. I get them. But what is a guy supposed to do? May I kiss you?
I'd be like, you know, I used to bring this up when I used to host Loveline all the time. By the way, the end of that story, which was Travolta showing up at Yuri the Hungarian chef's door later that night in his underpants. So I don't know what happened after that, but I'm saying that's the button to the story. I always used to tell. So I used to put it this way when I was hosting Loveline, and when we're talking in the late 90s, I would say, every office has a cool guy and every office has a creepy guy. And if the creepy guy, now I'm not saying he is creepy, he just looks that way, or you perceive him that way, you're not attracted to him or whatever that is. If that guy says to the young receptionist, hey, is that a new dress? It's looking good on you. She'll get creeped out by it. If the cool guy comes in, the cool guy can come in and go, hey, it looks like somebody had themselves some fun over the weekend. Tell me all about it. And she'll just laugh and tell him all about it. It's the same thing, but you're not wanting it from one person and you do want it from the other person. And the inherent problem with all this is they don't know it. Each person doesn't know it. You know what I mean? Your perfect example, like Hungarian chef. Your niece was not into this, or your cousin was not into this. John Travolta, she was into it. But the act is the same act, or it would have been the same act.
It was the same thing, the same come on. And like I was waiting for her to say, and then he, the chef, you know, came in anyway and got in my bed, and I'd be like, he's fired. I'm calling the police. He's fired, whatever the degree of it was. But I feel like we've lost the ability to differentiate. And that's the definition of insanity. You cannot differentiate what is what, do you know? It's how do you, I would be scared to death to, if I was a guy, to go on dates, because it's all about attention. You know, I've been with some of the most handsome guys in the world, and they're the most skeevy ass fucking pervy motherfuckers that came down the pike. And they're good and they're charismatic and they can do all this shit, you know, but that's what our job is, to be able to perceive and differentiate, you know, and we're not always right, but I think we're right a lot. I think there's a lot of things women can do to not be involved in scary situations. I know that one of my successful actions when I came to Hollywood, I decided I'm never taking a meeting with any man, any place other than a legit office in an office building where there's a secretary and there's a this and a that. I think that decision really helped me out. I have friends who asked me to go take meetings with them at some guy's house who was going to be in Malibu, and they were also going to take a hot tub. And I'm like, now, okay, maybe it's because I'm from Kansas, but I'm like, hot tub, Malibu, midnight. I've been taught you're in trouble. That's the danger zone. So I think we have to take responsibility too with and differentiate what would be a good move is what I'm trying to say. If I could talk to young women who are pursuing acting, I would say when you're called in for a meeting, make sure it's in a place where there are more people than one person and it's during business hours.
I
think that would be good advice. But then someone might say to me, oh my God, now see, you are against women and you think it's the women's fault that these things happen. And I don't. But I just guess that I was taught to put myself into situations with a little forethought.
Hold the phone for 1 second. I'll hit Madison Reed Mister here. Working from home, getting a little gray around the beard, fellas, maybe a little gray around the temples. Madison Reed Mister, it's a great blending natural color for your hair and your beard as well. You can go on their website, look at the before and after shots, and you can also look, find your hair color and match it up on the website as well. They don't have the shoe polish Sharpie look. I've used this stuff a few times. It comes in a little kit. You have the little gloves. Put the gloves on. Put the gel in your hands, and you just rub it together, and you just sort of the color gel, and you just wipe it. Put your fingers through your hair with it on there. Then you do the same thing with the activator. It comes in a little Mylar pouch. And you let it sit there for 10 minutes, and then you rinse. It's simple. It's easy. It gets the gray out. My wife, Lynette, loves it as well. It works. It's natural. It's the stuff. Well, they've been doing it for women's hair for a long time. Now they're doing it for men's hair. It's Madison Reed Mister, right, Dawson?
Go to MadisonReedMister.com. That's MadisonReedMR.com. And use code Corolla for 10% off plus free shipping on your first box. Again, that's code Corolla.
All right, so where were we? We were talking about Me Too. We're talking about, I think what you're talking about here is we're trying to kind of, whatever we're talking about, we're talking about racism, we're talking about Me Too, we're talking about Black Lives Matter, we're talking about all this stuff. It's like we're trying to legislate common sense. Like at some point, we just need some good, basic common sense that women need to know that yes, the way our society is and the way young men are and the way we have crafted society, that if you're 25 and you're beautiful and you're at a party and guys are drinking, someone's going to come up to you and someone is going to do something that's going to fall under the heading of weird or pervy or out of line or whatever it is. And we could say, well, that's wrong. It should never happen. Right. Except for it probably is going to happen, some version of it. And you're going to have to, and I would hope this for my daughter, to have the skill set to kind of deal with it. And I think there's a version of that for just about every facet of our life, like almost everything you don't like, a bad teacher, a bad cop. If you're a young black man and a cop pulls you over and he's being rude, we're gonna have to figure out a way to deal with that so people don't get killed. That's what I'm saying. The notion of defund the cops or it should never happen or I don't want to live in a world where it happens. Sorry, the world is filled with human beings. Occasionally they're bad. Occasionally they're drunk. Occasionally they're whatever. And shit happens. Everyone is going to have to get the skills sort of coping and negotiating and deal with it. If the cop is out of line, you got to get his badge number, but comply, live to fight another day. Or if the guy at the party is skeevy and pervy, then go talk to the person who's throwing the party. But you're going to have these skills. these sort of coping skills, these negotiation skills, these life skills, because the notion of we're just going to smooth out the highway so there are no bumps and there are no hills and there are no gullies, that's never going to work. We'll make it as smooth as we can, but the goal can't be zero tolerance for everything. Everything's always going to exist. We're human beings.
I like that. I like the way you articulate that, because it's true, and it's, we don't live in Candyland. We don't live. You can't make people not say or do anything, and it's such an arbitrary of what might be a. You know, it's walking on eggshells. It's such an arbitrary, what might be said to this person or this person. This person might go insane if you say this thing, and this person might not give a shit. I mean, you know, I remember when we were doing Cheers. I mean, my God, we would all be in jail if we had the same rules to follow right now. You know, I remember when our big game was, you know, we all shared the same shower, not at the same time, but the big game was figure out a way to get in there and take pictures of, and that wasn't the internet, but get in there and take photos, whoever is in the shower naked. And so there were many locks put on the door. You know, we really rigged it so no one could get in there. And then Woody went through the ceiling.
Woody Harrelson.
And then he unlocked the door, threw me the camera, and I took a picture of Ted. But now that would be sexual harassment, I guess. I think it was just funny and fun, and I still do. I feel like, can't we tell when someone's, you know, like if a guy says to you, look, if you don't give me whatever, then you're not going to have this job. That's another thing. That isn't okay. That is sexual harassment, and that is, you know, basically blackmailing you. Or if someone puts their hands in you in a horrible way and is molesting you, that's a different thing. And if someone rapes you, that's a different thing. And each of these things should have a different consequence. But if you don't look at everything also from that point of view, and you look at men and women throughout history, they play games with each other. You know, they flirt around. The things that you think are sexy and fun, and it's because of the intention behind it. The intention is good.
Well, context. I mean, without context, you know, it's like I was talking about earlier with Dennis Prager. Do you think the super religious elderly Jewish man is advocating for raping your wife? Do you think that's what he's, they think that he's pushing that out there? That's his plan for the deeply devout Jewish scholar? Do you think that's what he's telling people to do? Have some context, people. Use your fucking head.
It's about sound bites. It's why I want to have a podcast. It's why I like listening to you. It's like when a person has a point of view, if you can hear them out, there's a lot more sane people than we think. But the news, everything has been turned into a sound. I used to think it was bad before the internet, but everything's been turned into a sound bite. It's interesting. I could have interviews that lasted 6, 8, or 8 hours. I'd have someone following me around all day long, wherever I was, doing all these interviews. And it's down to a paragraph and a sound bite and whatever they decided to say about me, do you know?
Well,
and I'm done with this. I want to podcast, and even if someone doesn't want to listen, they can turn me off, but I could at least say something more than something, a 2-second clever quip.
I always think about the court transcript, like you were talking about the set of Cheers and the shower and Ted and Woody and everyone else. Imagine if somebody wanted to just turn that into a court transcript and they read it out loud, you know, and then they would lock them in, and then he'd climb over the top with a camera and blah, blah, blah. Like, the court transcript version of everything always sounds horrifying. It always sounds and that's what we're doing with the news. We're doing the court transcript version of it. You could take any encounter interaction you've had with friends or family members or lovers or whatever it is over the years, and you realize if you turn that into, and then he did this, and then she did that, and then he said to her, I'm going to kill you because I hate you, whatever. Now, you could have been laughing when you said that, but it's in the transcript now. You could turn everything into a horror show. And a felony. You could make everyone to just be a felon. If you just took the hijinks that you guys played on each other in a very good-natured way on the set of Cheers and turned it into a court transcript, especially if someone was going for something, like if someone was trying to lock you up or get money or whatever from you, what would that look like? It would, of course, look horrible. And that's what everyone's doing on Twitter, and that's what everyone's doing on the internet. That everything gets put into a court transcript-style thing and then pushed out there.
Right. And then there's nowhere. Now, this is my other pet peeve. I have about 5,000, but we can't do them all today. But my other pet peeve is that, and then if you're put out there to dry, hung out to dry, your comrades, your peers do not come to your rescue because they're afraid to rescue you. There have been several, you know, if I have a friend who's a celebrity or a celebrity that I don't even know, and I know what their intention was, and I know that they're a good person, and I know what they were trying to do, I'll fucking defend them on Twitter. But believe me, I've met Jonathan Knight from New Kids on the Block and Todd Kressley on Twitter because they actually jumped in and defended me when I was being attacked.
I want to hear that. I want to hear that story. Hold on, Kirstie.
Well. I don't know Jimmy very well.
Kirstie, let me just jump in here. Can you hang out with me and do some more of this?
I can if you can stand.
I can stand. I'm finding this interesting. I think I'm just going to call Audible Maxipata. Let's just keep going with Kirstie here. Let me just shuffle the deck. First, a quick 15-second JB Weld. The JB Weld is a proud sponsor of the Adam Carolla Show. Epoxy adhesives for both DIYers and pros, trusted for over 50 years, available at jbweld.com and retailers everywhere. It is JB Weld. All right, Kirstie, can you hang for a second? We'll take a quick break and we'll come back and do lap two.
Sure.
All right, we'll be right back.
Just $25, you get wine and gifts. Ace's favorite stuff or products from HDS. Every single month, you get the drink you choose. It's hard to beat cool stuff and booze. Adam's Monthly Nut. Adam's Monthly Nut.
Hey, Carolla fans, Mike Dawson here. I got some good news and some bad news. Bad news first, we're sold out of this month's Adam's Monthly Nut. Well, it's bad news for you, not necessarily for us. Good news is you'll still be able to get all the incredible products from the fine folks at Ready Patch and the Bug Bite Thing after this month's Adam's Monthly Nut. Head to ReadyPatch.com, that's R-E-D-E-E. To make sure you don't look like the Kool-Aid Man after a night out. And head to bugbitething.com to suck out the poison from the flying demons that are mosquitoes. A big thank you to both Ready Patch and the Bug Bite Thing for participating in this month's Nut. Stay tuned for next week's announcement of a brand new Adam's Monthly Nut.
All right. Well, we're going to keep going with Kirstie Alley here because I'm finding this conversation so stimulating. So thanks for staying with us, Kirstie.
Say that stimulating could be taken the wrong way.
Oh, yeah. On on point. I'd have so many questions for you. But let's talk about Cheers and the set and some of the stuff you guys did over there back in the day. Where'd you shoot that?
Paramount.
And how many seasons were you on it?
Six.
So they did five, and then you did six. I mean,
yeah, they did 11 seasons.
11 seasons overall.
Forever. If they kept doing the show forever, I would have kept doing it forever. It was the best. It was really a dream come true because I loved every single person on that cast and crew. There was just no bad egg. There was no animosity. We were all very different people, but it was just the most fun I've ever had in my life.
Woody Harrelson was just kind of getting started back then, right? And he seemed like an unlikely star. Like if anyone watches Cheers and they see Woody Harrelson on Cheers, you wouldn't predict that that guy would have such a huge theatrical career after that. His character was kind of well, his name was Woody, and he was kind of a weird guy, and he didn't have that sort of matinee idol good looks or anything. Like, you would have never predicted that he broke out of that and became a huge star, especially a leading man. Did you see that in him?
I saw it because when Woody would flirt with me, I was married, didn't stop Woody. Woody would flirt with me. He was so charismatic, you know, that I could see that he could very easily be a leading man. And he was always breaking girls' hearts. What Woody would do is he would bring his dates over and spend the night at my house. You know what? I never asked Woody why he was doing that. But I guess because I had a big badass house and it was sort of cool and fun. I don't know why. And I don't, maybe Woody was living in an apartment. I don't know. But he'd bring his girlfriends over and then he would go to sleep, they'd do whatever. And then he'd go to sleep and then his girlfriends would sort of come up and sometimes knock on my door and then he'd broken their hearts. And so I could tell he was a leading man in real life because all the women love Woody Harrelson. So then when I started seeing, and you know, he's so endearing on Cheers, you know, he plays he's the philosophy of life on, you know, he's the dim-witted Woody guy, but he's also the heart and the philosophy of the show. And that's how Woody is in real life. Oh my God. I'll tell you the best thing Woody ever did. Okay. So Woody and I used to play pranks back forth. I was filming a movie with John Travolta, and we were in Canada, and we were filming really late, and I hate night shooting. I'm bad at night. And so then this captain came, we were filming in an airport, and this captain came up to me and he said, my son is handicapped. He's severely retarded. He's been in a bad car accident. If you could come right after you're done filming, if you could just come say hi to him, it would mean the world to him because he just loves you on Cheers. And I said, okay, oh my God, this is so exciting. So we were filming, it's 2:00 in the morning. So I go up and here's this child in this wheelchair and it looks like he's about 14 or 15 and he's all bandaged the crew's standing around a little bit and I kneel down because he's in a wheelchair and I go, hi, it's really nice to meet you. And he goes, I love you. And I said, well, I love you too. And he goes, I know I love you. I said, I love you too. I'm so glad I get to meet you. And he put his arms on my shoulder. And he goes, I love you. I love you. And I go, I love you. I love you too. And then he's got his arms around me and he goes, I love you. I love you. And I'm like, okay, I love you too. And I'm sort of looking around like, hey, he's like getting a little carried away here. And pretty soon he's like, pulls me out of the wheelchair and he has me on the ground and he's like, I love you. I love you. I love you. And he's rolling around on top of me and I'm going, you guys help. And the whole crew is now, it's like a Twilight Zone movie. The whole crew is surrounding me. It was Woody.
It was Woody in the wheelchair.
It was Woody. He'd come in, he'd bandaged himself all up. He was like humping me on the floor going, I love you. I love you. And I'm like, oh, this is just a handicapped boy. I can't do it. I can't make him stop because that would be wrong. And then Woody had flown into Canada. He flew into Canada to do that prank.
Just for that.
Just for that.
Wow.
And oh my God, I was crying. I literally, he took it so far that I was literally crying and begging someone to help me.
Was the crew in on it?
Yes.
They must have been. Yeah, everyone was in on it. Yeah.
Like, help me. He's going to hurt himself. I've just been told he's been in a car wreck. So I'm like, help me. Help. He's going to hurt himself. You guys, come on, you guys.
And he got a captain, like an airline captain, to come talk to you?
Yes. He wasn't even a real airline captain. He was some actor that was, I think, maybe he was like, you know, a stand-in. I mean, not a stand-in. Maybe he was, we were shooting in an airport situation, so it seemed very real. But anyway, that was the story of that was every single day on Cheers for 6 years.
And he would bring his girlfriends to your house because you had a big house. And I guess have sex with them in some room. I mean, there's like a guest
room.
There
was a wing down this way, but a couple of times Woody knocked on my door. Now he'd been drinking, but he'd knock on my bedroom door. Remember, I'm married. I'm in there with my husband, and Woody would go like, do you want to come out here with me? And I go, no, Woody, I don't. And he'd go, come on, let's just have some fun. I go, Woody, God, get out. And he's so young, you know, at the time. And he would, He'd go, okay. Sometimes he would have a girl downstairs and he would still sort of do that. Flirt. We were all sort of flirty with each other.
Yeah. Well, Ted's a pretty good looking dude.
Ted was good looking. Ted is a really good kisser.
Oh, really?
Yeah. You know, I had this scene, you know, Ted and I are jacking around the whole show. Everybody's always jacking around on that show. We're never paying attention. It looks like we don't even, know. It doesn't even look like we're actors at all, or that we're putting on a show at all. But then in the scenes where a couple of times I had to kiss Ted, I was like, whoa, Ted is like a really good kisser. And I don't know about other actresses, but you know, if you're kissing really good kissers who are handsome, it, you know, I hear actors go, well, you know, there's a whole crew around, so you don't have any feelings for the person. Well, that's not really, if I'm with some ugly guy kissing him, then yes, I don't have any feelings for him. But I think it's very hard to be an actor for that reason. You're not usually going to a job like to the office and you make out, not that it doesn't happen, but that you go to your job and your part of your job is to make out with the guys in your office.
Right. Yeah.
So actors, you know, it's part of our job to make out with them. And he's a really good, he's a really good kisser.
Well, especially if you go on location somewhere. I mean, God, it happens all the time, but how could it not? Right.
I never cheated on my husband, but I will say that it was hard because here you are working every day. You know, you're on the set for 14 hours, you're making out with them, you're pretending like you love them, and then it's time to go home and you all go to dinner and you're all sitting with each other and laughing and everything's great. And you sort of start falling in love with them. It's how Elizabeth Taylor was married 87 times, you know.
Your husband at the time was Parker Stevenson?
Yeah.
Who is a pretty hot actor himself at that time. Good looking. Yeah. Kind of doing a series. God, well, he had a series like
Hardy
Hardy Boys, but he also had a few other ones, right? I mean, he had
Baywatch, and then he had he was in Models Inc., and then he directed a bunch of Models Inc. Yeah,
yeah, his stuff was like a little more serious, a little more crime fighting, and that kind of stuff. But he was a pretty hot actor during that same time period, right?
Yeah, and he's a hot guy. But when you go on location and you're on location, it's just, I mean, imagine, I don't think people really, I think they can put themselves in the place. You know, if you're going off and, you know, you're making out with Matthew McConaughey every day or something, you might have a crush.
I don't think people fully understand how they would act or respond in the same sort of situations, which is to say, you know, everyone always talks about, oh, these Hollywood guys, they're always cheating, or the women are cheating, or whatever it is. Well, like, look, if you drive a truck, you're not going to get that much opportunity. For instance, you know, I mean, I used to be on MTV every night. I understand what it's like to go into a bar in New York when my girlfriend's in LA and have two chicks walk up to me because I'm on the TV that's on in the bar at the time. So, yeah. And saying, no thanks, but no thanks to that is a tougher thing to do than not. It's one thing to like, again, it's one thing to drive a truck and not go out whoring when you pull into Phoenix. Like, that's fine. It's another thing when they come to you and start talking to you. And
right.
I was talking to the late, great, God, let's see. Oh, I just blanked on his name, but I'll think of his name in a second. From Three's Company. I'm just completely spacing on his name.
John Ritter.
And John was basically saying he was just in a book that was doing one of those tell-all books, and he was in the tell-all book, and you know, he's basically saying, I flew to New York. I was at the airport. There's like this great looking chick at the airport. She wanted to know, you know, if I wanted to share a cab with her back into Manhattan. I said, fine, we shared. The next thing you know, we're staying at the same hotel. You know, she wants to know if I want to have a drink in the bar of the hotel. Like, yeah, next thing you know, he's in a book. But what I'm saying is I don't know many guys that wouldn't get caught up in that. I just don't.
But it's also hard, it's hard not to, because, you know, like that incident, like say you're in that bar, that's hard, but that's one incident probably from one person. But it's like erosion. If you're doing a movie and you're on a set for, you know, if you're gone on location for 3 months and this person is sort of eroding you. I'm really proud of myself. I was married for 14 years and I never cheated on my husband.
You must have had guys coming at you all day long. I mean,
I did, but I was so flirty. I mean, I think, you know, when I say I didn't cheat on my husband, I'm proud of that. But what I did was even sort of worse, because I would say to guys like, you know, oh my God, if I wasn't married, I would be so into you. I would be so, you know, I was like the master manipulator flirter. And when I look back on it, if my husband was doing what I was doing, I would not have liked it. And maybe he was. I mean, he was on sets too. But I do think that, like, you know, it's like if you put yourself in a position, you know, you work in a real estate office, okay, and you're married, but then there's a guy that comes to work in the real estate office and he's really hot looking. And I don't know, maybe he looks like Patrick Swayze, and he's over there and he sits next to you every day. Maybe you're tempted a little bit. Maybe you have some temptation going on there every single day. But now what if part of your real estate job was every day he comes in and you're just holding, we want, you know, when you go show this house today, we want you two to go together and make out with each other all day.
Right.
So then, I mean, it's the weirdest business in the, when you really look at it.
Yeah.
Acting, showbiz, like you're saying, it's very weird because they're not really, you know, I don't, you know, if you're approached by a lot of people, I don't really even, they don't know me, first of all. So it would be who they think I am, you know, or
yeah,
who they think you are, or, but people do throw themselves at you. And it's easy for me when it's a one night kind of a thing. That's never been my deal. I've never really been promiscuous. That's never been my deal. But the erosion.
Yeah, they wear you down. Well, also, you know, it's kind of interesting. I want to get back to that part where you kind of flirt hard with them, because guys don't understand that. And I think there's a big chasm here between men and women, which is guys are very bottom line. Like, we want to have sex. Like, if a guy is talking about cheating or he's flirting with you or whatever, he wants to... He essentially wants to have an orgasm. That's kind of the end game. Like, that's it. It's very mechanical. You can break it down a whole bunch of different ways, but guys are very mechanical. So a woman who would be saying to a guy, listen, if I wasn't married, I'd definitely be with you because I think you're that hot. A guy can't really process that, because for a guy, it's almost like saying, it's like you're saying, I want to talk about eating a steak. And the guy's like, I want to eat a steak. And you go, yeah, I just kind of want to talk about it. And the guy's like, nobody wants to talk about eating a steak. You want to eat a fucking steak or you shut up. But you don't just want to talk about it. When they don't realize is women can just want to talk about eating a steak and never take a bite of a steak. And the guys can't process that.
Right. But being a dick tease, I think, to women, I can't speak for all women. To me, being really flirtatious, and I know I'm being a dick tease when I'm doing it, that's the game for me. The end game that you're talking about, the guy's end game, I mean, if I want that end game, I could have that end game, but it's not my game. My game is...
Right, but he doesn't know it. That's the problem. What's that?
This is so mean and horrible, and I'm going to say it. I used to want, like, right now I'm sort of lonely, so I'm going to open this box up. I'm going to take this guy out. I'm going to go, yo, how about this? Oh, you're so handsome. You're so this. You're so that. Okay, you're boring. Boop, put him back in the box. Get out another boy. Like that. So that flirting doesn't, it always made me feel like I wasn't a bad person. I wasn't immoral because I wasn't actually cheating. I wasn't actually finishing the game.
Right.
So it became fun to just flirt around a lot. But I can see your point of view. I don't think women do think like men.
That's the truth.
And that dance and that whole thing is probably more exciting or as exciting.
Well,
as
here's a philosophical question.
Oh God.
What you were doing for you was cheating to some degree, sort of emotionally or whatever, spiritually or whatever, because you were getting something out of it. You know what I mean? Like, maybe we should define cheating in a marriage as sort of you getting something out of it. Do you, you know what I'm saying? So it's like a woman could get fully naked and have a man massage her naked body, but that's not cheating, right?
Well, okay.
No, no, I'm stick with me on this. We're going on a long journey here. That's not cheating. Because it's not cheating to her, you know what I mean? And it's not to society either. But if a guy goes into the champagne room and he gets a lap dance, even though his pants stay on, maybe his wife gets angry at that behavior, right? So it's kind of, it's a little, it's not that technical, because on one hand, you're nude and the guy's putting his hands all over you. On the other hand, you're wearing your jeans and the chick's giving you a lap dance, but it's more sexualized. But what you were doing is a woman's version of cheating, or your version of cheating to some degree. You were
totally agree.
You were sort of getting pleasure with other guys, but your version of it is you keep your panties on, right?
My version is I'm taking it as far as I can possibly take it without having intercourse or having other sexual activities. So
right.
I could say to someone, you know, I've never cheated on my husband.
Right.
But I understand. I even sort of think it's worse because I think you can also get men to fall in love with you for real. And you're really fucking with them. Sort of. It's sort of a creepy cheating too.
Well, so here's the philosophical question, which is you in the eyes of society are not a cheater, but on the other hand, you're getting what you want away from your husband.
Yes, I'm a whore.
And no, I'm just saying you're being sort of satiated away from your husband. Your husband's not providing this thing. Now, obviously, your husband and men aren't interested in this version of cheating. They're not interested in the let's talk about it. They want to get to business. So then you could do this with multiple men over a course of years and not be a cheater. Your husband could sleep with some floozy out of town one time and he would be a cheater.
Yeah.
Even though you're both just kind of doing what you're wired to do. Do you know what I mean?
Yes. But see that psyche, that even when you say that, and I'm not even with anyone right now, it's like when you say, and your husband could then sleep with someone, I just get like full of rage. I'm not, you know, I would just, ugh. But they're not, I see what you're saying. Philosophically, it's sort of one is one and the other is the other. But that, I don't know, you know, if you complete the whole act, I guess that's my definition of cheating. But what I was doing was equal, or I think even maybe worse, because I was sort of a serial flirter.
And I imagine
Ed Bundy of flirting.
a lot of those guys must have really been smitten with you and thought something may happen.
Well, and you know, I would lead that this didn't happen with many, 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 many guys, but I would lead them like, wow, if I wasn't, you know, I don't know. And you know, when you have those talks on sets, I mean, they're so bullshit, you know, here we are. And I, you know what, when anything gets into something heavy and philosophical and, you know, like it was like when it goes back to like, how did I emote in this? I just want to throw up. I don't know why. Anyway, if it gets too heavy and philosophical, I always feel like flirting was just fun. But it does have consequences because you are, I don't think it's fair to make people think that you're falling in love with them. Why be married was my thought. Like, why am I married if I'm going to do this?
What did you get out of it? I mean, was it being desired or the attention or what do you see? Like I said, for guys, well, it doesn't
really, I never did it with anyone that I wasn't like crazy attracted to.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess I wanted to have, you know, that I guess that flirtation and that stuff feels fun and fresh and new. And that's probably why people cheat on each other. It's no different. You want that fresh, new thing with, and there's no responsibility. You know, you don't know what the guy's bathroom habits are. You don't know what he's like if you get in a fight with him. You don't know anything, really. It just feels like it's fresh and new. So I guess that newness feels sort of exciting or exhilarating or something. And also, I feel like if you, you know, I think women, and God, I'll probably get lambasted for this because it, but I do think women want to have that kind of love aspect and romance aspect. And I think men just want to like get down. So if you're flirting with someone, it feels like that romantic thing. It feels like the game, the interlude, you know, it feels like what is a, it's like foreplay.
Yeah.
Men, it's like, fuck, shut the fuck up. Just get your clothes off, you know? So so that may be what it, the fulfillment of being able to be romantic in a way and flirtatious. Like, I mean, isn't that how every relationship starts? You know what? Yeah. I realized it was really interesting was I never ever slept with a guy. I've never slept with someone the first time if I hadn't been drinking. What does that tell you? That tells you I would have had no sex in my life unless there was alcohol.
And now, you know, under California law, that would be rape. I mean, under the new definitions.
No, but you know, but you know, it's true. Like I'll probably drink twice a year. I don't really have a thing for alcohol, but I remember like if I want to cut my inhibition down and make myself real brave and gutsy, you know, I'd have a couple of drinks. And I have never slept with a man that I didn't, the first time I slept with him wasn't, I wouldn't say drunk, but had a few drinks.
You've been married twice, right, in your career?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And you never thought about, because when you got divorced for the second time, you were certainly young enough to find love and get married a third time. Never.
I lived with someone for 3 years after I got a divorce.
Oh, do we know who that person is?
God help us. No, but if you listen to my podcast, I have a special episode on it. No. Let's see. What is it called? What's that saying? You jump from the fire to the frying pan.
I think you go from the frying pan into the fire.
You do? Either way, it's fucked up. Oh, Lord.
Well, maybe, you know.
Not a good one.
I always wonder, I always think about sort of the burden of being a really attractive woman is. Like, the people constantly kind of coming at you and getting into these relationships. You know, I mean, there's a version of life that is a much slower life. You know, you live in the same town, you're married to the same guy for 45 years. It's sort of, you're not having all this temptation, these options, I guess, constantly like being thrown at you. Do you identify with this at all?
Like, got into this business too. I feel like there's a part of me that wanted to be an actor because I wanted, you know, the clothes, the men, the lights, the blue, you know, all the fanfare.
I want to, you were on an episode of Love Boat, right?
Yes.
I've been watching the shit out of Love Boat. Now, I watch Love Boat, and then Dr. Drew watches Love Boat, and then we gossip about the episode that we saw. But I'm trying to think, as I was looking through your IMDb, was it 1983? Now,
it probably was, because I hadn't been dating Parker very long, and Parker was asked to be on Love Boat. And we were at dinner with the producer, and the producer said, would you possibly be interested in doing Love Boat with him and playing I think I played his wife. And I said, oh, yeah, I'll do that. And so that's how I got into that one.
Because that was pre-Cheers for you?
Oh, yeah.
You didn't do Cheers until later. We're looking at
I started doing Cheers in 1987.
We're looking at a picture of you with some serious cleavage.
Nice rack. Can we say that anymore?
My God. Love Boat, man. They let it hang out in that show. And you're there with Tom Bosley. I think that's Tom Bosley from Charlie's Angels.
He was. Yes.
Was it Tom Bosley? Yeah, from Charlie's Angels, right?
I think in the storyline, I was trying to make my husband jealous. I think that's why I had that dress on.
I want to know. I'm asking for Dr. Drew. I'm not even asking for myself, but I'm going to ask you. I can never figure out, like, where did you guys film that show? Did you ever get on the boat? I know it was all in front of a green screen, but I am so obsessed with Love Boat, and I'm especially obsessed with it because I'm looking at it through the lens of this was our society. I mean, on the subject we're talking about, on the Love Boat, Dr. Bricker was the physician who was on the Love Boat, and he openly hit on every chick that walked onto that boat, and those were storylines. I mean, that's how crazy our society was back then, that the physician on the boat would openly be sexually coming on to female passengers on the boat, and that was all. There was a laugh track played behind it, and he would get them back to his cabin and be banging them in his where he conducted his medical exams.
That's where the love part came in.
All right, let me hit Simply Safe here. Most home security companies trap you with high prices, tricky contracts, lousy customer support. There's only one that's a no-brainer. That is Simply Safe. There's two eyes in there. Simply Safe, everything you need to protect your home, an arsenal of sensors, cameras, and every room. Windows and doors tailored specifically for your home. Professional monitoring day and night, ready to send police, fire, medical professionals, whatever you need. You set it up in under an hour. Just peel and stick. The batteries last up to 10 years. No technician required. Just go online, get it set up. They'll send it to your house. You get up and running in under an hour. No contracts, no pushy sales guys or hidden fees or fine print. Starts at just $15 a month. U.S. News and World Report named it Best Overall Home Security 2020. Right, Dawson?
Head to simplysafe.com/Adam and get a free HD camera for our listeners. That's simplysafe.com/Adam to make sure they know that our show sent you.
All right, let's take a quick break and come back for our final segment with Kirstie Alley right after this.